Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. In 1947, 2 years after World War II ended, scientists created the Doomsday Clock. The clock measures the likelihood of humans destroying the world, principally by nuclear war. It's set every year and now sits 89 seconds from midnight, the closest it's ever been. It started at 7 minutes to midnight. Look around and you'll see why the end of the world feels nigh. During his first term in 2018, President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un exchanged nuclear-themed taunts, with Trump posting on social media that, quote, "I too have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works," end quote. Last year, Vladimir Putin updated Russia's nuclear doctrine, lowering the bar for justified use of his country's arsenal. And this summer, Israel and the United States bombed Iran in a bid to cripple any nuclear capabilities in that country. Such saber-rattling and often cavalier threats make the events of the summer of 1945 more relevant than ever. In July and August 1945, 80 years ago, the Manhattan Project concluded a 3-year scientific mission to develop nuclear bombs. First came the Trinity test in the desert of New Mexico. Here is how the terrifying unknown was portrayed in Christopher Nolan's Oscar-winning movie Oppenheimer, with Matt Damon speaking first as General Leslie Groves, followed by Cillian Murphy as scientific director Robert Oppenheimer.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Nothing in our research over 3 years supports that conclusion, except it's the most remote possibility.
How remote?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
Several weeks later, the two atomic bombs designed in New Mexico devastated the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. By the end of 1945, the bombs and the after effects of radiation killed an estimated 210,000 people in the two cities, many of them on the first day. Historian Garrett Graff has just published a new book on these horrifying, world-changing events. It's called The Devil Reached Toward the Sky, an oral history of the making and unleashing of the atomic bomb. He joins us this morning to discuss the book. He was also here a year ago to discuss a book on the D-Day landing. Garrett Graff, welcome back to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So your book covers a lot of territory, from the scientists who figured out that nuclear weapons might be possible, to the 3-year frenzy of the Manhattan Project, to the nuclear arms race that threatens our planet and existence. You include 500 voices in this book, and it was originally a 1.4 million word manuscript. So let's start there. How did you decide what made the finished version and what was the most painful cut?
I should quickly clarify for listeners that the finished book is substantially shorter.
Yes, that's a good point.
it is 90% shorter than that original draft was. This month obviously marks the 80th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the surrender of Japan and the end of World War II. And I think in many ways this 80th anniversary feels so particularly poignant, in part because it represents an unofficial final passing of the participants, the people who lived World War II, the Greatest Generation, as well as the final passing of the generation of survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So this project really for me began as the D-Day book did a year ago at the 80th anniversary of D-Day, because we have at this point effectively every first person memory we will have of World War II. And so I wanted to pull together the stories and the voices and the experiences and the memories of those people to tell these apocalypse world events anew for a readership and a generation who will only ever know them as history. And I think, to me, one of the challenges of history is that the way that we teach history often makes events seem neater, cleaner, simpler, and more preordained than they felt to anyone who was living through them at the time. So a big part of the power of oral history to me, both with the D-Day book last year and with this new one on the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project, is to try to put people back in a moment where the participants didn't know the outcome, where, you know, they didn't know whether Adolf Hitler was going to develop an atomic bomb first. They didn't know whether the Allies were going to be able to win World War II. They didn't know whether an atom bomb would even work. And that's the unique storytelling power of trying to tell these events through the lens of oral history.
And as for the most painful cut, does something come to mind?
Well, I joke, I live in Vermont, so I joke that doing oral history is a little like boiling maple syrup, that you sort of start out with a giant vat of sap and then just boil until you've gotten rid of 90-95% of what's there and sort of get it down to the essence of the story. But, you know, you played that great clip from Oppenheimer at the start of the segment, which was a fantastic movie. I loved the movie. It's remarkably historically accurate for a movie. But I think we often oversimplify and over-romanticize the Manhattan Project as, you know, just J. Robert Oppenheimer and his band of merry physicists on the Mesa in Los Alamos. And a big part of my book is really trying to trace the full arc and spread of the Manhattan Project. That the magic, in some ways, the majesty of the Manhattan Project, it comes in places like Oak Ridge, Tennessee, not that far from where y'all are. And Hanford, Washington, Hanford, the site where we refine the plutonium, Oak Ridge, the site where we refine the uranium. And these are entire cities that we create out of, you know, remote mountain valleys in Tennessee, in a desert in eastern Washington, where each of those cities, Oak Ridge and Hanford, employ 100,000 people by the end of World War II. You know, entire secret cities stood up by the Manhattan Project, filled with workers and residents, you know, doing 24-hour shifts to get the atom bombs ready. And you really get the sense of the sheer scale and scope of the Manhattan Project in that. You know, on August 6th, 1945, the day that the existence of the Manhattan Project is announced to the world for the first time, the bus system in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, is one of the 10 largest public transit systems in the United States. And it serves a city that no one knows exists and that doesn't appear on a single public map.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that. So a lot of this book, as you say, or a fair amount of this book, is more than just Los Alamos. You talk a lot, the people involved talk a lot, it's an oral history, about their experiences in Tennessee and Washington in particular. You mentioned these cities springing up from nowhere. I was really curious where you went to find these testimonials. I mean, you dig out information such as this idea that sort of the local hillbillies, as they're portrayed at the time, are more capable in some cases than the PhDs when it comes to certain jobs and tasks. And I think equally fascinating is this idea that so many of the people, probably 90, 95%, maybe more, did not really realize what they were doing. They knew they were doing something related to the war. They didn't realize the scope and scale of what was to come.
Absolutely. And that adds, I think, so much drama and sort of pathos to the story of the Manhattan Project. I mean, this is, you know, the Manhattan Project today still stands as shorthand for audacity and daring. And what makes it all the more audacious and all the more daring was that it was all done in secrecy, you know, all done amid the labor material shortages of wartime, you know, all with unproven science and technology. So a lot of this material comes from some incredible oral history projects. The Oak Ridge Public Library actually did an incredible large-scale effort to capture the memories of the people who worked at Oak Ridge, many of whom, as you said, were basically high school girls, which was sort of who you could hire in the summer of 1943 and 1944 amid the labor shortages of the war. And there was this real tussle because Tennessee Eastman, which was the company that was brought in to run the Oak Ridge facilities for the U.S. government in the Manhattan Project, went to these PhD physicists and said, you know, we're going to hire all of these young women fresh out of high school in eastern Tennessee. And, you know, the PhDs were like, no, you need a real science background in this. And they did this head-to-head test of these high school girls and the Berkeley PhD physicists. And it turned out the young women, they were known as Calutron operators, Calutron girls, the Calutron being the machines that they were operating, outperformed the Berkeley PhDs in terms of producing and refining uranium. And as we were talking about with the secrecy, what is so remarkable is most of those workers at Oak Ridge learned the word uranium for the first time on August 6th, 1945, when Harry Truman announces the existence of the Manhattan Project. They've sort of worked on this project, run these shifts, run these machines, sometimes for years, without ever knowing what the thing was that they were doing.
By the way, I want to emphasize that was the hillbilly references, neither Garrett's nor mine. Those were in the testimonials and the oral histories dating to that time. But again, just fascinating that they're building these cities sort of across the country. And then you have Los Alamos right there in the middle. How fast did these empty out once the bomb was dropped?
There were large-scale layoffs immediately after the bomb. At the end of World War II, much like there were sort of massive demobilizations across much of the country for the war effort. But, you know, Oak Ridge, Los Alamos, Berkeley all go on to become the foundations of the national labs in those locations that still exist today.
We are going to take a quick break. We have much more to discuss with Garrett Graff and his new book about the 80th anniversary of the development of nuclear weapons and the bombing of Japan. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their curriculum aims to develop curiosity among middle schoolers and help them foster skills like critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and social awareness. More at bischarlotte.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest is historian Garrett Graff. His new book is The Devil Reached Toward the Sky. It's about the making of the atomic bomb and the destruction and death caused when Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed 80 years ago this week. Let's listen to President Harry Truman speaking to the nation after the bombing of Hiroshima.
With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
So let me start, Garrett, with the context, which I know you know, but maybe some people have forgotten, that Harry Truman became president 4 months before these bombs were dropped. And he learned of the magnitude of this project when he became president, not while he was vice president. How much did Truman grapple with this decision before it went forward?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is one of the more remarkable twists of the story. Is Harry Truman becomes president after FDR's death in the spring of 1945, and at his first cabinet meeting, Secretary of War Henry Stimson stays behind and says to him, basically, you know, hey, Mr. President, we got something that we need to talk about. I've got something to come and tell you about. And he shows up with a briefing that not only explains the possibility of an atom bomb, but lays out the scale and scope of the Manhattan Project, this $2 billion effort that is employing literally hundreds of thousands of people in secret cities around the United States. But also says, you know, we're going to have, we think, a working nuclear device in a matter of weeks, and it's going to be up to you to decide how to use it. And to understand a little bit of that moment, you have to back up, because I think we, particularly when we're talking about the anniversaries as we are this month, we immediately associate the atomic bomb with Japan and the war in the Pacific. But the roots of the atomic bomb really lie in Europe and Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. Because what you come to understand when you get into the research and sort of the stories and the memories that I tell in this book is how it's this group of sort of mostly Jewish refugee physicists and scientists in the 1930s who flee Europe ahead of the anti-Semitic programs of the Third Reich, ahead of the enveloping cloak of fascism, and come to the UK and the United States, you know, basically to save their own lives and careers and families, but arrive on our shores with this very dire warning of the possibility of an atomic bomb. And that they spend basically the first 2 years from, you know, across 1940 and 1941, before the U.S. is even really in the war, meeting with everyone that they can in government and the military, including at one point Albert Einstein writing Franklin Roosevelt to explain to him the possibility and warning of an atomic bomb, because they are terrified that Adolf Hitler back in Europe is at work on developing an atomic bomb. And that, you know, the irony is that the US military and the US government want nothing to do with this project. That sort of meeting after meeting happens and everyone's like, yeah, like, we have no belief that this could actually possibly work. And, you know, thanks for your warning. We're going to get on to our next meeting. And that it is only, ironically, on the Saturday of December 6th, 1941, the final day of peacetime in America, that the U.S. government launches the sort of full-scale effort that we now call the Manhattan Project. And of course, it is the next day Pearl Harbor is attacked, and, you know, nothing is the same ever again. But what really motivates the scientists through most of the Manhattan Project is the idea that their old colleague, this guy that they know well, Werner Heisenberg, is still back in Germany, one of the world's most renowned physicists, and is surely, surely leading a massive effort, equally massive effort, to develop a German atomic bomb.
And that contact, go ahead, I'm sorry, Garrett.
And so by the spring of 45, where when Harry Truman is sort of presented with this decision, there are really three camps of scientists by that point, who have sort of mixed different sets of feelings about using the bomb. One chunk of them are sort of sad the bomb's not ready earlier. You know, there's a whole set of them that are saying, like, hey, I wish, you know, the original timetables for this weapon were that it was going to be ready in 44. And wouldn't it have been great if we could have dropped it on Berlin sometime in 1944 and saved, you know, a year of the war in Europe, you know, saved all of those American lives, all of those Allied lives. There's another set of the scientists who make an appeal directly to Truman and the White House in the sort of closing months of the war, who basically say, hey, we signed up to build an atomic bomb to defeat Hitler. Hitler's already defeated. We don't have any reason to drop an atomic bomb on Japan. Let's not use this weapon at all. And then there's sort of a third group of scientists, and I found these in some ways the most moving quotes, some of the most moving quotes in the book on the Manhattan Project side. Because, you know, we forget just how big World War II really was. And, you know, so many of these scientists, they have family members who are involved in the U.S. war effort, too. And so for many of the scientists, they can name the people whose lives were saved in their own families on the American side because the atom bomb was used. And, you know, there's this woman who I quote, you know, celebrating the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima back in Los Alamos, who says, you know, my brother was a Marine flamethrower in the invasion of Okinawa and was due in to the second wave of the invasion of the home islands of Japan later in 45. And, you know, basically, like, my brother is alive because I invented the atom bomb.
And for Truman, how long of a process was it for him to get to the point of saying, yes, this is the step we need to take?
It was not long. There was not a lot of sort of hemming and hawing, actually, in the upper reaches of the administration. And in part, again, you have to go back and look at, I spent a lot of time in the book sort of talking about this and tracing this, what you might call the permission structure of the spring of 1945 and summer of 1945. How, again, when we think back on World War II, we just lose sight of the scale of death and destruction that was unfolding then. You know, there were 60 million people who were dead in World War II by the summer of 1945, about 45 million civilians, about 15 million combatants. You know, you'd already had, you know, moments like the Bataan Death March. You'd already had, you know, the siege at Stalingrad. You'd already had, you know, the entirety of the Holocaust. You know, there of the, you know, American troops sort of still liberating and discovering concentration camps as Harry Truman is making the rounds, you know, trying to figure out what to do with this atom bomb. And in the spring of 45, we are firebombing Japan on an almost nightly basis. The deadliest day of World War II is not the atomic bombings in August. It's actually the spring firebombing of Tokyo known as Operation Meeting House, where we kill 100,000 Japanese in a single night. And that over the course of the rest of the spring, we bomb a total of 66 Japanese cities, you know, destroying 40, 50, 60, 70% of the cities in, a single night. So much so, this firebombing is so deadly and so devastating that actually the U.S. war planners set aside, they quote unquote save Hiroshima and Nagasaki from the firebombing in order to demonstrate the destructive power of the atom bomb, because they realized that if they firebomb these cities first, there's not going to be enough of the city left in order to actually even tell how bad the atom bomb is.
That's the voice of Garrett Graff. His new book is The Devil Reached Toward the Sky. One thing that's clear both in the book and just in general history is that the ensuing nuclear arms race, the world we live in today, the culpability of America in that tends to ebb and flow through different eras, as much history does in the way presidents are ranked or any other debate you want to come up with. Where we sit right now, as you think about this as an historian, what is America's culpability in the nuclear world that we live in?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that comes clear in reading and going through the testimonies and oral histories and memories of the survivors, the Hibakusa, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is nuclear weapons are not just another weapon. They are fundamentally different weapon than anything else in the human arsenal. These are community and civilization killing weapons that we come to understand as such, so much so that the central organizing principle of international geopolitics for the 8 decades after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that these weapons can never be used again. And, you know, that is the backdrop of the entire Cold War, is that these weapons are too terrible to contemplate the US and the Soviet Union ever actually coming into conflict and risking the possibility of a nuclear exchange. At the same time, I think here in 2025, one of the things that I think we don't think enough about on a daily basis is that we are probably closer right now to nuclear danger and the use of nuclear weapons than we have been for most of the 80 years since. You know, this year already, we have seen the India and Pakistan come into open conflict, which are the two largest nuclear arsenals in the world to ever come into conflict. We've already seen the U.S. and Israeli raids on the Iranian nuclear program, and we've already seen America's geopolitical instability and sort of the tenuousness with which our allies now view their alliances with the United States as driving new conversations around nuclear proliferation that even a few years ago would have been unthinkable in Europe and in Asia. I mean, countries like Germany talking about developing a nuclear umbrella, you know, Korea talking about whether it should be developing its own, South Korea talking about whether it should develop its own nuclear weapons, Japan even having some conversations, which is, you know, unthinkable for 79 and a half of the last 80 years. And that, you know, I think at this moment where we are about to lose the last living survivors who remember how terrible these nuclear weapons really are, you know, there's a deep irony and worry that over the next decade, we are going to actually see more countries than ever choose to develop nuclear weapons.
I think a really important point here is that you go through how these bombs were made, how they were deployed, what happened to the people who were the victims of this bombing. One was a 9,000-pound bomb. The other was a 10,000-pound bomb. Obviously, one's uranium, one's plutonium. But the scale of that destruction, how much more powerful are the nuclear weapons that have gone unused since then compared to what was used in World War II?
Literally hundreds and up to thousands of times more powerful than the weapons that we saw in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The weapons in Nagasaki and Hiroshima were measured in kilotons of TNT. The thermonuclear weapons, the hydrogen weapons, hydrogen bomb weapons that now make up you know, big chunks of our nuclear arsenal between us and Russia and China, are measured in megatons, you know, which, you know, an order of magnitude even larger than the atomic weapons. And so, you know, even at the scale of using 100 nuclear weapons in the world today, you know, you are looking at the possibility of nuclear winters and nuclear sort of impacts to the environment that would lead to the starvation of hundreds of millions, if not a billion people.
I asked that question because we can't really even fathom what you're describing in this book, much less many, many degrees beyond that. We have much more to discuss with Garrett Graff. His new book is called The Devil Reached Toward the Sky. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation with historian Garrett Graff. His new book is The Devil Reached Toward the Sky. Garrett, I'm curious, have you ever been to Los Alamos or Alamogordo?
I have been to Los Alamos, and I've actually also been to what is called the Nevada Nuclear Test Site, which is where we tested nuclear weapons, you know, right up through, you know, the 50s and 60s, and, you know, still today have sort of nuclear tests that go on there, although in a different format.
And I'm curious, particularly with Los Alamos, as with some other or many other historical sites, any kind of feeling come over you, any kind of sense of the history that played out there?
Yeah. So I also, as part of the book research for this, I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you know, there you definitely feel the presence of the history and sort of the pregnantness and poignancy of those memories.
How do they depict that? You know, what is the scale and scope of how they depict what happened there?
Yeah. So they're a little bit different in both cities. You know, there's a peace park in each of them that sort of marks, you know, the memories of it. Hiroshima has actually left one of the most famous sort of buildings that was destroyed, now just known as the Atomic Bomb Dome, in the exact stage of wreckage that it was after the bombing in August 1945. So you can sort of go there and see this steel frame of the dome that was pretty close to the what's known as the hypocenter, the place where the bombs exploded. And, you know, I think these are cities that very much work to keep alive the memory of what happened there. And, you know, the mayor of Hiroshima still sends a letter to the, you know, chief executive or head of state in every country that does a nuclear test, that, you know, every time there's a nuclear test anywhere in the world, the mayor of Hiroshima sends a letter to the head of that country saying, hey, really encourage you not to do this. Like, this is not a good thing for the world. And let me tell you, as the mayor of Hiroshima, you know, these things are not weapons we should ever use again.
That's a perfect segue into, you spend a significant portion of the book showing the aftermath of the atomic bombs falling on Japan. There's this incredible feat of ingenuity and manufacturing and knowledge that goes into the American effort, the Manhattan Project. Then there is the wreckage and the aftermath. An important point you make is how much the U.S. government censored any accounts of what these bombs did. What are some examples that caught your attention?
Yeah, so the bombs are so big, they're so devastating, that it takes a long time for anyone to really figure that out. It actually takes Japan several days, the Japanese government several days, to figure out, you know, what has happened to first Hiroshima, then Nagasaki, which is interestingly like a part of the sort of puzzle to U.S. officials about why it takes Japan a while to surrender, is they didn't expect it would take Japan so long to understand what had happened to Hiroshima, but the bomb so destroys the communication networks that it takes a couple of days for word to sort of get out of Hiroshima about how bad the devastation is there. Then it takes the U.S. military sort of a matter of months to make their own assessments, because they send teams in to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in after the Japanese surrender on September 2nd, and as the U.S. occupation begins. But then clamp this very tight level of censorship over any discussion of the bombs, the devastation, the scale of death, and particularly the radiation poisoning that is sort of beginning to make itself known and continues to kill people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki straight through the fall of 45 into 46, and you know literally almost every single day since then, as well. And it is not until the really 1946, almost a year later, when John Hersey of The New Yorker is able to get into Hiroshima and writes an article about the scale of devastation in Hiroshima that is so long that actually it runs as the entire issue of The New Yorker. The issue sells out coast to coast, in minutes or hours, and is so stark and so shocking to Americans that the radio networks actually read his story aloud in specials on the radio, so that Americans sort of for the first time really understand the power of an atom bomb.
And in that light, I want to share just one of the many oral histories that you have found and shared in your book. This is one from a factory worker named Sanao Kanazaki. Quote, "The riverbank was covered with people so totally transformed that I couldn't tell who was who. Still, I went from one to the next, checking. The survivors wandered throughout the city. We ate anything we could put in our mouths, unaware that it was poisoned by radiation. Most of us came down with high fevers and diarrhea. Some died. Truly, living or dying made no difference. It was all hell. End quote. I'm curious how much of this material you were familiar with. You obviously know this is among the most horrible things that's ever happened on this planet, if not the single most horrible thing. But how familiar were you with these graphic testimonials of exactly how horrifying it truly was?
Yeah. The memories, the oral histories, the testimonies of these figures, the Hibakusa, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are some of the most searing reading I have ever come across. And I say that as someone who has done, this is my third book of oral history. I wrote an oral history of 9/11 and wrote an oral history of D-Day that came out last year. And so even set against the stories of the survivors of 9/11 and D-Day, neither of which were sort of days for the weak or faint-hearted, these testimonies stand out. And I think part of what also stands out is the bravery and strength and conviction and vision that the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have carried forward to ensure that their stories are heard and that they are remembered. The Nadan Hyanko, just won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, which is the confederation of A-bomb and H-bomb survivors, who have dedicated themselves for decades to the work of remembering the bombs and remembering the stories that they, remembering their stories to ensure that they are the, in their dream, the last survivors of a nuclear weapon in the world. When I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I got the chance to talk to a survivor who was 3 years old on the day of the bombing in Nagasaki. And she, told me sort of her brief memories of the day, but also, sort of her family's story before the bombing and after. But what just really struck me was, she does not speak English. What she had done was she had worked over years to memorize her story in English to ensure that Americans could hear her story directly. And that, you just sort of imagine how much work that must have been, and sort of her other people like her who had done similarly over the years, to how much work it took to make sure that their stories were told and remembered.
You mentioned earlier the mayor sending out a note every time someone tests, the mayor of Hiroshima sending out a note every time a country tests nuclear weapons. You just mentioned the survivor memorizing her story. We talked earlier about the power of oral history and making it real for people. And as huge as this topic is, and I can't believe there are many people that don't at least know a little bit about this, I wonder how much of your motivation was getting people to slow down beyond kind of the thumbnail sketch and really think about how horrible this is, and not to be cavalier in thinking about the risks that we face right now.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I also think, part of what is so amazing about the Manhattan Project is it is this story that is simultaneously one of humanity's greatest triumphs and humanity's greatest tragedies. That in those final chapters, like there's this sort of incredible juxtaposition across the last third of the book or so, where you have the stories of the American bomber crews who are delivering these bombs to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and are celebrated and received as heroes, you know, and have these great missions and, you know, pull off these, you know, incredible bombing runs and evade the destruction of the bomb in order to escape safely themselves. And then, you know, the Enola Gay, which drops the bomb on Hiroshima, lands back in Tinian in the Marianas Islands at the American Air Base there. And, you know, they have medals pinned on their chest on the tarmac and then literally go off to a barbecue party to celebrate the dropping of the atomic bomb in Los Alamos, in Oak Ridge. You know, everyone remembers the dropping of the atomic bomb as one of the greatest days of the whole war, you know, that there are parades and parties and, you know, drunken bacchanalia, as people sort of celebrate that the bomb worked and, you know, we're going to end World War II with this. And at the, and then you sort of switch between those celebratory moments and then the reality of what is taking place on the ground, first in Hiroshima on August 6th, and then Nagasaki on August 9th. And you know, it's this two-sided story of, as I said, this moment of, you know, one of the most fundamental achievements that we have ever had, you know, the unlocking of one of the basic building blocks and powers of the universe, and then the deployment of it, you know, causing one of the worst things that humans have ever done to one another.
It is gut-wrenching. I want to end on a slightly lighter note, and so I'm going to ask you this question about Colonel Paul Tibbetts, who flew the Enola Gay, also named it for his mother, and you include some histories and recollections of the testing of the B-29 bomber. There were many ups and downs and troubles with getting the plane designed right, and you include the way that Colonel Tibbetts persuaded some leery pilots to maybe take another stab at flying these planes, no matter the risks. What did he do?
Yeah, and you know, we've spent a lot of this time together talking about, you know, the worst and darkest moments of this. But, you know, one of the things that really I enjoyed in this book is there's plenty to laugh at along the way. I mean, there are some very funny sort of stories of workplace hijinks and the larger than life characters who fill this. Paul Tibbetts, the pilot of the Enola Gay, who ends up dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, you know, he is not a random Air Force pilot. He is, by, you know, the middle of the war, one of, if not the best bomber pilot in the U.S. Air Force, and is brought back from Europe to do this very, to help launch the B-29 program, and is dealing with all of the early gremlins of a new aircraft development. And there are a lot of men, the male pilots, who are very skittish to fly this thing. And so what he does is he goes down and finds two women, WASPs, the Women Air Service pilots, and teaches them how to fly the plane, and then sort of flies this plane around to all the B-29 bases, where this plane lands, rolls up, and then these two women get out of the cockpit. And basically after that, he makes no male pilot is willing to admit that they are too scared to fly this plane. And instantaneously, he sort of got all of these men on board, because golly gee, if a woman can fly this plane, how can I not?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, it is a fascinating tale. Garrett Graff, it's nice to have you back on Charlotte Talks. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Garrett Graff's new book is called The Devil Reached Toward the Sky. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.